Hello and welcome to Talk to Me with me, Shane Maloney, a show where I seek out interesting and accomplished people who have thought-provoking stories to tell. My guest today is David O'Byrne, who is one of my best and longest friends. David has led an interesting and varied life to date. He's been a naval officer cadet, held senior management positions in pharmaceutical manufacturing facilities, and he's a specialist in operational excellence and leadership. Dave's real passion is people and the places that they work in. That is creating great places to work, allowing people to flourish. In my conversation with Dave, we talk about bad bosses, how they're created, and the impact they can have on the people they work with. How the combination of values and behaviours are the number one predictor of success. And David shares the stories of some of the more difficult decisions he's had to make and the impact that's had on his life. David has a unique perspective on the world, always curious, always questioning, which is one of the reasons we've remained friends for so long. I hope you enjoy my conversation with David as much as I did. All right. Well, David, thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure.
We've been friends for, I was trying to work this out earlier on. It's what, 30 something years now at this stage.
Don't do the maths on that, please.
Okay.
Let's just live in denial.
Okay.
Denial is fine. Yeah. Oh, 32, I would say.
Yeah.
It was 32 in September.
Yeah, been a while.
It would have been in September that we would have first met, really.
Yeah. And I, because of that, I know quite a bit about your backstory, you know, and we think of it, it's what life is, you know, it's just the things that have kind of happened to us and happened to you over time. But I think actually, when you sit back, parts of it are really fascinating. You know, it's your life and it's what you've done, and it's I think you'd agree it's been somewhat different. You've done some interesting things and you've moved about a bit. So I was wondering maybe if we start where you are today and maybe work backwards a little bit. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're up to at the moment, how you spend your days, what excites you?
Yeah, sure. And I guess, yeah, I've often kind of thought if you look back at the full CV, there's an awful lot of different things that I've done and I've tried, and I guess some people look at it and say maybe it tells a confused story, but for me it all hangs together and it all makes sense. And I think right back to even when we started hanging out, when I would have been in the Cubs and Scouts, was leadership, and I was always keen to lead the team. And in fact, our friendship kind of, you know, really kicked off when we discovered our shared love of you know, wanting to join the military and stuff, and be leaders in the military in our future careers, which both was experimented with to
some degree. I think that's the right phrase, experimented with. Yeah.
So yeah, currently I'm working for a boutique consulting firm as their managing director. Great bunch of guys based out of Nottingham, in the UK. And they are on a mission to make work better for everyone. They've done a huge amount of research over the last 25 years or so across Europe and beyond, but mostly across Europe, looking at what makes great companies, and really looking at employee engagement and how you can put the structures in place. Is engagement and how people feel about their work. They are the products of the jobs people are doing, the teams they're working in, the managers they have, and that whole experience. So oftentimes people think you should love the company, and that's not how it works. You have to kind of go, you know, I'm going to make your job interesting. Tell me how you would like, how you could do your job better. That's how you start employee engagement, by asking and listening. And the guys at Workforce Innovation, which is the company's name, they've been central to the concept of workplace innovation, which looks at empowering employees, driving change through people. So getting your team to actually not just deliver the change, but actually to be involved in lining the business up and setting the direction of that change. And it's something I'm absolutely passionate about, because I've had some bad jobs. I've had some jobs I absolutely detested. I've had some bosses I absolutely detested. And usually those things are, they go together, you know, which tells you something. And so I'm passionate about making people's lives better as well, because we spend so much time at work. So, yeah. You know, and you know, you talk to people and say, oh, I don't want a career. I just want to go to work and come home. But you're still going to spend 40 hours and you're still going to go to the pub and talk with us, you know, whether you're in the most junior or low level menial work, or you're running a corporation. It's still a huge, huge part of your life. And it drives so many of the other things you can do in your life. And you meet successful people and you ask them if they're motivated by money, and they are to a point, you know, and I feel the same about money myself. It's like I'm motivated to a point. I'm motivated to the point where I no longer need to worry about it. And then it's just about the stuff that it can do for you. So like the big one for me this year was, I wanted to take my kids to Legoland. My kids are obsessed with Lego. And so would I like to have a private jet? Of course I would. Don't be ridiculous. But the fact I could take my kids to Legoland and take them to stay in central London in a nice hotel and stay at the Legoland resort. So
So once you reach that sort of level of satisfaction, exactly. It's like, well, what else is there?
Exactly. And then it's about what you're doing from 9 to 5 or 8 to 4, or, you know, if you're someone like yourself and myself, Shane, you know, all the hours that are on the planet, you know, so it's work is never ending for some people. And that's, I don't see that as a burden. I see it because I enjoy what I'm doing. And I always seek out those opportunities to do stuff that I want to be, you know. The barometer for me is if I'm sitting in front of the television on a Sunday night, am I dreading work or am I
the theme tune to Glen Rowe comes on? How do you feel?
Yes, exactly. or, you know, am I excited? Do I actually have the laptop out? You know, writing a note for myself for the morning because I've just thought of a great idea for someone to contact or for a project to run or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, there's absolutely loads of stuff there that I could delve into. There's one that jumps out at me is bad bosses. And the reason that one jumps out at me, we could maybe talk a little bit more about it, is because, you know, nobody gets up in the morning, looks in the mirror and says, I'm going to be a bad boss today.
Yeah.
I'm going to annoy anyone that I work with. It really does come across when you're talking about, you really are quite passionate about this. And as you said, yeah, you know, there's a money motivation, everybody does, but there comes a point where that no longer counts. So when you use your own experiences, I suppose, you know, you've worked under some great people, you've worked under some not so great people. How do you think these people end up in that sort of position? How do they end up where they're not particularly good at what they're doing? Like, how can organizations let that happen?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Cliched and saying, you know, everyone gets promoted to the level of their own incompetence. So, yeah. You know, someone's good at a job and then they get promoted to the next job and they're good at that job, so they get promoted to the next job. And that is just that. You know, someone's a great engineer or someone's a great navigator or someone's a great technician or whatever, and they get promoted. And generally speaking, when we think of promotion, we think of becoming a manager. We think of taking on that role of managing other people and other people's work. And very often, in my experience, you find people who are reluctant because not everybody wants to manage people because it's tough. End up managing other people because they were, as I say, a good engineer. And those skills aren't necessarily mutually inclusive. In fact, very often, if we're talking about engineers, and we, you know, we're in safe company here.
Yes, indeed, yes.
You know, they're not. Scientists, again, sometimes, and this is I'm speaking in massive generalities here, because I've met some engineers and some scientists who have been the best bosses I've ever worked for. In fact, two of the best bosses I've ever worked for. One was a chemist and one was a chemical engineer. So I'm, you know, like any theory or any hypothesis, you will find evidence to prove it wrong.
Yeah, there's always an outlier.
But in general terms, people that oftentimes are reluctant people managers.
Okay, so that's a really good way of putting it, actually, reluctant people manager. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And they're flexing skills that they're not necessarily good at, and it stresses them and it puts pressure on them, and they're not doing the stuff that energizes them.
Yeah.
And so, of course, over time, you know, they end up becoming bad, because we all start off as new managers, right? That's the first step. We start off as being new managers, and then it's how that journey goes. The other thing that I think is you know, I've seen with bad managers, and the distinction here is bad from the perspective of the employee. They might be great from the perspective of the employer, because they might be knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, they might hitting be their budgets hitting their and all of that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm specifically talking here about bad for the employee, because it'll eventually come back to bite the business. Because values and behaviors, that's the number one predictor of success. Because the decisions you make drive the results you get. And over time, people can cope with stress. And over time, you will get people to go along with, you know, someone who's pushing a team too hard or making decisions that are too close to the edge. But over time, they'll bite you. And what you see is that the person is gone. They've been promoted before the carnage actually...
Right, you okay, know, yeah.
Kicks in. But to go back to your question, you know, what can organizations do? I think it's making sure that we have routes for people who are technically very good to develop, that don't necessarily involve managing people. You know, or even decoupling senior roles from people management. So I've experienced one company where HR took over the traditional line management stuff. So they were a software company based in Finland, if memory serves, and they realized that they were promoting their software engineers. Their best software engineers were getting promoted to people management roles, and then they were becoming their worst people managers.
Yeah.
And they were losing them.
And they were losing their good software engineers.
They were losing their good software engineers, and they were losing the up and coming software engineers, because they were being managed by these previously good software engineers who were terrible people managers. And what they did was they decoupled the people management from the project management. So the best software engineers got promoted into a project management lead software engineer role, but they didn't have to have the kind of development conversations, because you remember, being a good manager isn't just about hitting the numbers on a day-to-day basis. It has to be about developing the people for the future. So these guys might have been able to keep a project on track, but they weren't talking to the junior development engineers or the junior software engineers, saying, you know, where do you want to go next? Or, well, your performance has dropped off a little bit. Is there something going on at home? So HR took back those roles and responsibilities, and it freed up the engineers, the senior engineers to go back to be good at what they were doing.
Go back to being good engineers again, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. You know, it gave people who needed support from a line management perspective the support that they really needed. You know, so they could go and they could ask someone about, you know, holidays and sick pay, and they could go and ask about, you know, further education and career development.
Yeah.
With people who were HR, who were people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And who weren't invested in their, you know, what's going on in the day-to-day of their projects. I mean, very often you go for your end of year conversation with your manager, and it becomes quickly apparent that your end of year conversation has more to do with the last experience the manager had of you than what's happened throughout the whole year.
I would agree with that.
So, yeah, you know, and then it's a wasted opportunity for you, for the manager, for the company.
Yeah.
Because the processes are there, but we haven't given the managers the skills and to capture everything that's happened during the year and to be able to separate, you know, me from, to go back to my production background. I always think you're getting stuff out the back door. So if your manager is the production manager and his sole focus in life is what's going on at the back door of the factory, then does he really care about all the great stuff you did in January, February, March around the customer visit or something like that? No, he's probably completely forgotten about that. And he's just, all he's thinking about is that, you know, last week we didn't hit our number for the end of the month.
Yeah, yeah. He's just thinking about yesterday, today and tomorrow.
Yeah. And that's, again, I think you made a great point a while ago. He didn't necessarily set out to do that. He probably wants to be a good boss. But he's being measured and driven to that kind of last day of the month figure.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of a parallel topic linked to what you've just been saying. I mean, I worked in an organization where they had a really good conversation around a similar, it was an engineering-based organization. And, you know, they realized, so rewarding people from a monetary point of view is also tends to be linked to where you sit in the organization and getting promoted. And so you've got an issue with, we say, technical people, engineers, where they get to a certain point in the pay scale. And in order for them to progress beyond that point, then they need to take a manager's role. And you had the organization kind of going, in a way, I don't want you to. You know, you'd be a terrible manager. You're a great engineer, but you're unhappy, and I'm got my hands tied behind my back because I can't give you any more money. Because with this pay scale structure where people sit, and how do you fix that? So, unfortunately, I don't think it actually got implemented. But there was, you know, a really interesting discussion around how do you reward the people who are actually making the widget or doing the design work or, you know, doing the core business without forcing them down some sort of management track, which really doesn't suit them. Which kind of ties into what you were saying about, you know, you've got your good engineers and you turn them into bad managers, and that's not good for anyone.
Yeah. I've seen it in an organization I work for, large pharmaceutical multinational, and they just had separate paths, and it was very clear. So you had the I think they had five or six different classifications. So you had a classification for, you know, for frontline workers, so that kind of fitted for operators on the shop floor in a factory, you know, mechanical fitters, you know, the people making the drugs up to from entry level, same for labs, you know, people entry level into the labs up to a certain point. They were on a kind of a business path. And then once you kind of came to the next kind of rung, then it divided. And again, then so graduates maybe would come in at this level where you came in on a management path or you came in on a professional path. And they ran in parallel, almost to the level of CEO on the professional path. And really interestingly, there was a similar path on sales, and there was a similar path for scientists, so the R&D type scientists, because you don't want your R&D scientists, you know, if they're really good R&D scientists, you don't necessarily want them getting distracted with holiday requests.
Yeah.
Right? So you set up the structures, and there they had. So if you wanted to be a manager, you could, you know, I was there, you know, when I joined the organization, I was in the lower end of the manager ranks, but I could see the paths that were open to me. I could keep going up the manager path, and that meant that, you know, you're managing people, and then you're managing supervisors, and then you're managing managers, and then you're managing managers across multiple sites. And it was very clear the rungs in the ladder. But equally, and which is the path I followed, you could get promoted, but you could get promoted back into the professional stream. So, and I did have a direct report in that role, but my focus was on, as a professional, as an individual contributor, on delivering projects in the organization. at that level. So you're taking on extra responsibility. So you're getting a promotion, but you're moving back into the professional track because you don't have this kind of managing managers type responsibility in your new role. But I was equivalent. I was being paid equivalent to, in fact, actually, people on the professional track were getting paid more than people on the managerial track, which is interesting, right? That's okay. The reverse of what you're talking about in that yeah. large engineering company. So they recognized that, professionals, scientists, salespeople have different career paths that would be beneficial to the organization and to the individual. So you could be a sales, you could be a sales manager, and you might have a manager designation, or you could be like a super sales professional at the top of your game, and you could still be on the sales track. So you're just like maybe leading a product line, but you're not necessarily leading all the people that are working on that product.
Okay. You, when we first started talking, you went straight to the concept, the idea of leadership. Mm. And it was important to you, and it was something that you naturally kind of gravitated towards. Why did you and why do you want to be a leader?
That's a complicated question. So the immediate thing that springs to mind to answer that is go, I don't know. but I'm guessing that's not going to work for you, is it?
Well, that's why it's a good question.
Yeah.
We have time.
I think I'm... yeah, it's good. That's good. I'm driven to make sure other people are okay. So it's one of the things that really satisfies me, that energizes me, is making sure that other people are okay. And so in the work environment, okay is, that people are delivering the goals that the business needs, but that they're doing it in such a way that they're benefiting from it too. And it almost is that simple. And so on one hand, it's like, I don't know why I get off on that. I don't know why I feel so satisfied if one of my team gets promoted, but I do. I take more pride and enjoyment from other people's success. So I led a project a few years ago and several promoted out of the project, including me. But I got much more of a kick out of seeing my former direct reports faces when they had gotten promoted and seeing the satisfaction in their faces and the difference it made to their lives than I did from my own promotion, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. It's an interesting sort of take on what your motivation is and and why.
Yeah.
It's a word a lot of people just kind of throw around these days, and everyone wants to be leaders and, leadership is important and everyone's got it on their CV and things like that. But, I know you, so I know you many years. So I know that it really is a very important facet of who you are and your life.
It's that combination of getting the job done, but getting it done so that it also benefits your team, And that for me is the difference between a good boss and a bad boss. The good boss is focused on the big picture. So not just this week's target, but next week's target and the target for the week after. And so realizes that he must bring the team with him or her.
Excellent. Thank you for that.
No problem.
Let's just change tack a little bit. So I'm always curious about, the people who've done well in whatever they've chosen to do, and people that I admire, and I'm always interested in learning. Somebody's got something to teach, pretty much everyone. Is there anything that you've learned which is high impact, which, now you kind of go, I wish I started doing this 10 years ago, or I wish, something that you've learned along the way that you kind of go, this isn't even 80-20, this is like, 95-5 type thing. I really, I really wish I'd been doing this years ago.
Yeah. What jumps to mind straight away is the importance of understanding where you are when you go to fix something or when you go to solve a problem. It's taking the time to understand the current state. And so it's, for me, in my current environment, leading a small business, it's, you know, as simple as mapping the process. So what problem are we trying to solve? Is there a process? And there's always a process. There's always a process. If there's people involved, if there's steps there that need to be followed, mm-hmm. there's always a process. And it's taking this time to understand what that process is, what it actually is, right? And people get hung up on what it should be, but start with what it actually is. Understand where, because if you do that, if you take the time to understand where the process currently is, then you can fix it. If you just start talking with the hypothetical, this is what we want the process to be, you miss out on the opportunity to learn from why it's failing at the moment.
Yeah, people misunderstand. They take the picture they have in their mind about what something should be, and they confuse that with the actual current reality.
Yes, yeah. And then you don't understand where it's breaking down, where the disconnects, where the opportunities for failure in the process. And I had a really satisfying conversation a few weeks ago with someone I used to work with. And this person was very, very skeptical about, you know, process mapping and lean principles and a lot of the stuff that I do on a day-to-day basis. And they left the pharmaceutical industry and they were currently working for a legal firm. And she said that, you know, she ended up having to get them to the lawyers and the people in the firm were wasting huge amounts of time and effort on storage, on storing documents, on scanning them and filing them and then retrieving them. And so she ended up having to take them through a process mapping exercise. And her comment was like, what have you done to me? She said, like... But it was great... It was really satisfying for me that she reached out to share that story. It really made me laugh. But it just shows that you can apply these principles of mapping the process anywhere. You can apply it in a law office. I'm doing some work currently with a childcare facility where we're mapping out how they gather the data that they gather on the children throughout the day, and how they use it afterwards and how they store it. So it's understanding where you are. And then the next step is understanding where what the problem is. So people, you know, again, I'll pick on engineers, and I do that as someone who has some engineering qualifications and talking to a chartered engineer. We jump straight to solution mode. We jump straight to, I want to solve this problem. Yeah, and we don't spend enough time going, well, what actually is the problem?
Yeah, define the need.
Actually, it's a problem. And the analogy I always, yeah, define what the problem is and define where you want to be. But start where you are. There's a couple of analogies I use. You know, if you're starting on a journey, you definitely want to know where you're going. But unless you know where you are, you can't possibly plot a chart. You can't possibly plot a course to get to where you're going. That's one. The other I always use is you know, the analogy of the plumber as a tradesman who comes to your house, and he doesn't just come, you know, the plumber doesn't just rock up to the house with a hammer. He brings a van, he arrives in a van full of tools, and then he brings his, you know, his go-to set of favorite tools in his toolbox. And then he comes in and looks at your problem, and the first thing he does is he stands back and he looks at the problem, and he, you know, unless there's water pouring, you know, in which case you need to do an emergency stop, right?
Mm-hmm.
But once he's stopped the flow of water, he will step back and look at, you know, the big picture, and that whole kind of stepping back and going, it's a big job.
Yeah.
And we're often in business, that's what we need to do. We need to take a step back, take a big gulp of air, get oxygen into the brain, think about where you are, where you want to go. And take time up there, because if you take the time up front to understand what the problem is, where you are, and where you want to go, then there's going to be a whole lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see there's a definitely a theme. You know, when we started the conversation, you know, you used the phrase, you know, ask and listen. And you can see that coming out here again now, you know, take the time to understand the current situation and where you are. And the whole thing of, you know, communicating is a two-way medium, you know, it's,
yeah,
you can ask all the questions, but if you're not listening for a response, then what's the point? You're wasting your time. You're wasting the other person's time.
Yeah. There's a massive clue in nature, right? In biology. We have two ears and we have two eyes. We have only one mouth.
There you go. There you go. Excellent. Okay. All right. Let's jump around a little bit here. This is one that I'm always particularly interested in, maybe because I've potentially had so much experience with it. The concept of failure, or as I more accurately, you know, put it, apparent failure. It's really something that I'm fascinated with. From what I've seen and experienced, you know, failure is the name we give the situation when events do not match the preconceived ideas that we have about some future state that we choose to care about, you know. And considering how crappy humans are at predicting the future, I'm not surprising that we don't get the desired outcome more often. And there's a lot of negative emotions associated with failure, you know, guilt, shame, anger, you know. All the greatest hits are in there. But, you know, if you're not trying things and in inverted commas, not working out, which we call failure, then you're not really growing. So can you talk about any, you know, failures, or we call them apparent failures, which actually have contributed to your growth?
I have greatest hits. I can crack out any one of them for you. I think that's a good way of looking at it, though. You know, a cynic might say that, you know, you're rewriting history if you go back and you look for the learnings. But, you know, very few people, you know, things work out exactly how they're planned. And look, maybe that's a good starting point. So I always wanted to be in the Navy, right from when, you know, when we were, when we met first in Mr. Kelly's class. Always wanted to go to sea, always wanted to be in the Navy. Worked really hard in school to get the grades. And it worked out. I got into the Navy. I landed my dream job right off the bat, 18 years of age. I got a cadetship in the Naval Service, which should have set me up for a really fulfilling career, the career I'd always wanted. A lot of my identity at that time as a teenager was built around that. I was quite a, you know, I didn't drink. I tried to be healthy. I was very, very driven. Picked my subjects for my Leaving Cert specifically to get into the Navy. Was in the Reserve Naval Service for a number of years. Spent as much time as I could with those guys. So, yeah, there was a massive, massive success. And it was a success. I set out to achieve a goal and I achieved the goal. The failure came when I started the job and I realized pretty quickly that actually maybe this wasn't the right career for me. And that's then when your good old Irish Catholic greatest hits comes out and you get guilt and shame because so many people, because you don't accomplish something like that on your own. Your parents invest a huge amount of time in you. Your teachers invest a huge amount of time in you. Your superior officers in the Naval Reserve invest time and effort in you. Your friends invest time and effort in you. And then you're going to go, oh, I don't like this life. I don't necessarily like the people that, you know, you have a picture in your head of what it's like going to be like in the officers' mess in the Navy. And then it turns out to be quite different. I'm not saying it was bad. It was just different. It was different to what I expected.
It didn't match that kind of preconceived idea you had.
Exactly. It didn't match the preconceived idea I had. And maybe I was naive. But it's who I was.
Now you're 18. You're allowed to be.
Exactly. And that's the thing. That's the key. Looking back as a 40-year-old, to kind of go to 18-year-old you or 19-year-old you. You know what, mate? You were okay. You had an idea of what you wanted. Reality didn't match up with that, and then you made a judgment call, and said. And this is what I'd encourage other people to do: is like, do you want to continue doing this? You know, can you adjust your expectations without kind of taking away from who you are, without kind of changing your personality, without changing your core values and your beliefs? Can you realign? And sometimes that works out. Sometimes that works out really, really well. And other times it doesn't. So for me with the Navy, it didn't. It didn't work out. Mm-hmm. I look back at it as one of the best decisions I made. Because
or to leave, or both?
Both. Oh, crikey, both. I'm so happy I got in. Because I think I always would have regretted it. I always would have wondered and wished, and I'd have been looking out the window, because I've been lucky enough to work, you know, with beautiful views of Cork Harbour, where the Irish Navy is based. And
yeah,
I would have been looking out the window, looking at the ships sailing in and out, going, oh, if only. Whereas now, if I see them and go, oh man, I was on that ship for a while, we had some really good fun, but I'm glad I'm out of it. I think I made a really, really sensible decision. Because I realised that I like being around my family. I realised I like being around my friends, and that I like kind of a quote-unquote normal life.
Okay.
You go to work and you come home to your own bed in the evening. And so if I had stayed, I would likely, you know, at this stage, I would definitely have been captain of a ship at least once, maybe twice. And the thing about life in the Navy is whether you're the captain or the cook, you're still away from home. You're still away from your family. You're missing birthdays. You're missing. And I think I just realized that my values place an awful lot of importance on being around for those family occasions. Because I come from a big extended family and we're very close. And so I've absolutely no regrets, and the course my life has taken since then, although it hasn't always been straightforward, and it certainly hasn't always been easy, I'm really happy with that decision to get out. And it felt like a massive failure, and I can remember the night I went home to tell my parents that I was definitely, this is it, I'm leaving. And they were disappointed because they'd obviously invested a huge amount of time and money helping me to achieve my goals and my dreams. And I remember driving back down and saying to my mother and like breaking down in tears, going, who am I now? Because I had invested so much of my personal identity into being Dave who wanted to be in the Navy and then Dave who was in the Navy. And I didn't know who I was in a post-Navy world. So that for that was a crushing blow at the time, and I had to go in and reinvent myself and all my life goals and the rest, but it can be done, and I've had to do it, you know, once or twice since then, and it gets, I won't say it gets easier, but I think when you when it's forced upon you, as it has been, you know, more recently, you kind of go, okay, I can do this. I can, you know, I know what my life goals are and I know how to achieve them. And okay, this situation didn't work out quite how I planned. Some of that is down to me and some of it is down to external factors, but none of it defines me. If that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And thank you for sharing that. I mean, it must have taken quite a bit of courage as well. You would have been 20 or something like that at the time.
I was 20, I think, yeah. I think it was just around the time my 20th birthday.
Yeah, when you consider, you know, there was a long list of people there that you named who have invested time and effort in getting you to that point, and to reach that decision and pull the trigger and to execute it and say, actually, no, this is not the life for me. You can tell from the story you've told, it was difficult, but I must have taken a lot of guts to actually to do it. But I suppose if you know deep down that it's right, you know, you've got that totem to kind of hold on to, because you've mentioned the word values quite a bit in this conversation. It's obviously, you know, you spend a lot of time, you think about the values that you have and hold, and they're obviously very important to you. And I think at times like that, it's not even the goals, if you will, because, you know, goals come and go, but you know, values are the core of kind of who you are.
Yeah. That's that whole kind of, can you go to sleep at night? Can you, are you, when you look at yourself in the mirror, can you look yourself in the eye and going to go, yeah, okay, that was a difficult decision to make, but I can live with it. And again, that's another key thing about being a leader is making tough decisions. Particularly if it has a negative, quote unquote, negative impact on you or your team or a goal in the short term. And that's what you see often, touching back on the bad boss conversation from earlier on. People who are unwilling to have a tough conversation or make a tough decision in the short term will never win in the long term, because you have to. And it's never popular, particularly with people in operations, you know, people who are focused on goals, people who have a lot of kind of goal-focused energy. Sometimes you have to take a hit this week to achieve the bigger goal, you know. And if you're not prepared to make that tough call and take the bit of heat, then again, are you allowing yourself to slip into the category of bad boss? And that very often could be bad boss for the company, for the organization, as well as for you and for the team, you know, and it will bite you in the end, but it requires a bit of moral courage to kind of go and speak some truth to power and say, we're not going to do this today because we need to do ABC in order to achieve our overall objective.
Yeah. There's other things which are more important right now than the numbers at the end of the week.
Yeah.
Let's carry on that theme. So, I mean, that was obviously it was a hugely influential time in your life. Mm-hmm. You had, you know, the experiences of getting in, of the experience that you had within the naval service as part of, you know, doing your officer cadetship program, and then, you know, leaving it. And there was a period of time, particularly, you know, obviously you spoke about being away. I mean, it was during that period of time you and I really didn't have a lot of contact with each other, partly because of the fact that, you know, you were away. And it was
pre-mobile phone as well.
It was, yeah. I mean, you were one of the first listeners. People that I knew that had a mobile phone. I can still remember your original number.
So can I.
But
yeah.
So you go through that and you come out the other side of it, and you said it arms you for when the challenges come down the line, in future days. Talk to you about right now. What's the biggest kind of challenge you've got on your plate right now at the moment, and how are you trying to tackle it?
Oh, that's a good question. The biggest challenges are almost always around people. And expectations, both yours and theirs, and communicating where those expectations are maybe, shall we say, not realistic, or where the actions required to meet those expectations are not being followed through. So, you know, you meet with people. You put plans in motion. You talk a lot about what you want to achieve, you know, where you are now. Going back to earlier on, the process is the same. Yeah. Where are we now? What's the current state of the organization? Okay, that's the current state. Where do you want to go? You guys own the organization. You guys are there, the top dogs. What do you want from the organization in 3 to 5 years? And what are we going to do over the next 1, 2, 3 years to make sure we achieve that? And then you put plans in place, and those plans need to be executed. And so it's not all about, you know, it's not all kind of airy-fairy strategic thinking. You need to, okay, we've done the strategic thinking. Now we need to execute and we need to be tactical. And it's that piece around people not following through on what they committed to. And people kind of
turning words and ideas into actions, really. That's the action step.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so going back to the whole speaking truth to power and having difficult conversations, it's really around going back to people who own the organization you're working for, or going back to your managers and just kind of saying, you know, you said that we wanted to achieve this goal. You committed to following this course of action. As part of that, you needed to invest this resource or complete this task. And that's not been executed satisfactorily. And that can be a very difficult conversation to have with your superiors in an organization. And so that's, I guess at the moment, that's where I find myself kind of on a day-to-day basis, just kind of going, you know, with the owners or the organization, just saying, okay, you have these goals for the organization. We agreed a course of action. And you were not following that course of action. You're off doing other stuff. And it's very, I think it's very easy when you're a business owner to be busy working in the business. So busy doing tasks. And so a lot of people are very comfortable with being task focused. And so, you know, and how does that vary from being goal focused? I would say I'm focused on a goal. So I'm very focused on getting to a certain sales figure or a certain number of clients, or a certain volume of product at the back door in my old life.
Yeah.
And so you need to then work on the tasks that are going to achieve that goal, regardless of what those tasks are, regardless of how long it takes to achieve those tasks. Some people are just focused on tasks and it's like, well, I need to do this task and then I'm going to do the other task. And they're just kind of going through the motions. And that's what you expect of someone who's quite junior, someone who doesn't have a lot of experience, someone who is, you know, I don't mean this in a derogatory sense, but someone who's just going through the motion, someone who's just looking for a paycheck, not looking for a career. And that's fine. We need those people in organizations. But when those people are at the top of the organization and you're trying to break their habits, potentially of a lifetime, where they're just going through the motions of task, and being really busy saying, but I must do this task. And that, yeah, okay, you must do that task, but you must also do this other task that you agreed to do. And so if it takes you twice as long, then look, suck it up, buttercup. That's what needs to happen.
Yeah.
So again, it's showing leadership, but it's for me, it's a really difficult challenge in that you're trying to lead people who are, as I say, the owners of the organization. And so it's a very fine balance between giving really constructive feedback and not pushing it too far. That, you know, and we should always be conscious it's not pushing it too far, because if you push people too far, they get stressed and they become counterproductive and they're no longer going to give you their all. And so it's similar in that regard. It just feels different because they're the owners of the organization rather than being subordinates on a team.
Okay.
Just to round that point off, it's easier when they're subordinates on a team because you can say, stop doing that task.
Yeah, because you've got some level of kind of direct control over the
people. Yes, at some point, if you absolutely need to, you can go to the command and control toolbox and kind of go, I'm telling you now to stop doing that activity. Yeah. Just stop. I'm ordering you, in inverted commas, to go and do this task over here. If someone is senior to you, or if someone is you know, the owner of the organization, that is a much more difficult conversation because you don't have that power.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Kind of this next kind of question is somewhat motivated by, in my mind's eye, I'm thinking about that time post after you left the Navy, and we all go through. I mean, that's probably an extreme example, but you know, we all get periods in our lives in general where we kind of, you know, lose our mojo, if you will. Kind of the world gets on top of us a little bit and it just all seems a little bit difficult. Or we just simply, that zest for what we were doing before just kind of gets eroded over time. Is there anything that you do to try and get you back in the groove again? Is there anything in particular that, any tools or techniques that you can use to kind of snap out of that?
I think it's about going back to trying to find stuff that energizes you and trying to fill up. And it's something I've struggled with over the years and something I've never been particularly good at. You know, if you're in a particularly bad funk, a bit of exercise is great. For me, it's swimming. For me, it's being in the water. I love the water. So being in the water is fantastic. And that will get you to a certain point. But it's really, it's trying to get back to tasks or goals that really energize you. And so for me, it goes back to helping people. So if I can get myself back into a situation where I really feel like I'm helping people, that starts to fill back up the energy reserves. And it's the key for me. And it's probably a bit easier now that I have kids, because there's always stuff to be done. You know, yeah. You can't.
When you have young kids, something you can necessarily opt out of.
Exactly. And it can be really, really energizing. And it's also going back to look at your goals and maybe see, is there something you can pull forward, or is there, is there a goal you can start stretching more towards, or is there an intermediary goal? So you can say, right, you know, I'm not going to get, you know, this is a long-term goal of mine. What can I do right now to act and move closer to that goal? Very often, I think when people get down or when people hit a funk, they try to rest and they try to recuperate. And sometimes that is required. But I think people play that card for too long and it ends up hurting.
No, I would totally agree with that. I've learned that over the years. You know, I need a break, and actually, yeah, maybe you do, but I think you also need to take action, do something, and you will feel better.
Yeah. Like, I'm quite jealous of people who are big into fitness and exercise, because I'm not, as you well know. Mm-hmm. But I do think that is a great way to, you know, set yourself a goal, be it a couch to 5K or a marathon or a triathlon or learning to swim or hiking up a mountain or, you know, a goal that is readily achievable. And so, yeah, doing something that just makes you feel like you've done something, take action, push the body. And I think very often when the mind is stressed or the mind is overactive or whatever, maybe you need to push your body a bit harder, you know. And so I'd imagine if you've done a marathon, you probably want to spend the next day then, you know, getting good nutrition and maybe reading a book or looking at the sky or something, you know. And so should we not do the opposite? You know, when our mind is bent out of shape and we've had a perceived failure or, you know, or even look, let's not be negative about it. Maybe we've just hit a goal. Maybe we've just hit a big career goal. We've got that project over the line, or it's the end of the month and we've hit our numbers.
There's a void there. There's a, you know, just as you, I think that's a really great point, because a lot of people, you know, I've done a few things. Like, I've done like a major piece of work. I did a master's thesis, and I did it while I did the writing up while I was working. And, you know, it just consumes your life, and you can't wait for the date for it to be over. And don't get me wrong, it's wonderful, you know, when you hand it in and it's finished, but then you're like, what do I do with all this time?
Absolutely. Like,
what happens now?
I had a very similar experience recently, where I finished my MBA last year. You know, wrote up my dissertation while working, got to the end, and I thought I'd feel relieved and I didn't. I felt like someone had stolen my teddy bear. Because I, so much of me, again, you know, made the same kind of mistake as I'd made in the Navy. So much of me was invested and wrapped up in the NBA.
Yeah.
That when it came to an end, there was that void.
There was nothing left.
And you're so busy in the run-up to the finish of these things that you don't maybe give yourself the time to plan. And
it's a cliff edge. You know, it's a cliff edge.
It's
there one day and it's very intense because it's the end.
Yeah.
And then it's gone.
You hit submit. Yeah.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that. So I'm thinking again of people in sales and people in operations. You get to the end of the month. And I heard someone describe it fantastically during the week. You know, you've run a marathon and the next Monday morning, you're back to mile one. And so you need to celebrate those wins or give yourself a break after those losses, because on the next Monday morning, you're back to square one. And if you carry over the stress and the tiredness of hitting that goal or the pressure and the downer of missing it into the next month, then it's going to impact you. You need to give yourself a break. And so you need to make sure that you carve out the time to read the book or go for the long walk or go for dinner and drinks or whatever is your thing. And don't let society and Instagram and everything else tell you, and, you know, Business Insider, 12 things that great leaders do at the weekend. Forget that. Forget all that nonsense. That's what those people do at the weekend. You have to figure out what you do at the weekend and what energizes you. And don't just kind of go along. Sure, get ideas, but don't feel that you have to be
superhuman. Don't ape somebody.
Yeah, run your own race.
Stay in the crows coming for you there, are they?
They are, yeah.
No, that's excellent. That's excellent. You know, nobody, we often think, well, sometimes people think about themselves as, you know, I did this and I did that. But I think in reality, we've all got a team around us, you know, formally or informally, that helps us on our road to success. Like, I don't know, a great tennis player's got a serve coach and they've got a fitness coach and they've got maybe a psychological coach. Who's in your team? Who do you have around you in your extended team that's helped you achieve what you've achieved to date?
Yeah, I mean... I think you are probably a central part of that extended team. And it's really important to have friends who you can trust and rely on and speak with. And you can be open with and not have to always be okay. You have to have people in your life with whom you can kind of go, I'm not okay. I need to talk to you about this. And it's not, and I don't have the answer. And I'm really blessed to have yourself and Ken, two best friends for many, many years, 30 plus years, who I am in regular contact with. And I think mobile phones and WhatsApp and Facebook have enabled us to stay in contact. Couldn't have 20, 30 years ago. I mean, you say that, you know, for the time I was in the Navy, we didn't really speak. And even beyond that, it was only when we kind of happened to be back at the same university again together that we were able to rekindle the friendship, and then technology enabled us to keep it going beyond that point.
Yeah.
I also have a wonderful wife who is very, very patient with all my mad notions and is a great confidant. But I have a coach. So I have a business coach. So independent of my friends and independent of everything else, I have a business coach who I've been working with now for, I think it's a personal coach, a leadership coach, if you like. And I have been working with him on and off now for probably three years. And we don't talk all, you know, we talk maybe 3-4 times a year. But it is fantastic to have someone who is just there to listen and hold up a mirror and ask some difficult questions, but someone you can just kind of talk through a problem with. And I really, and not everyone is like this, but I like to talk through a problem. I think by talking.
Yeah, you verbalize, so for me, to try and think.
Verbalize, exactly, yeah. So, and something my poor wife really struggles with. So I'll be saying stuff and she'll be like, what? No, I thought the plan was something else. And I'm like, yeah, no, this isn't the plan. This is me thinking.
Yeah, I'm just having an idea. This is what me having an idea sounds like.
This is what an idea looks like, yeah. But even recognizing that and being able to say, verbalize that to her is really, really helpful, because she obviously thinks in a different way. That's one of the things that my coach has taught me about is how other people process information, and how to adjust your style, or just even let them know that my style is different to their style, and just open their eyes. And some people think it's a lot of bullshit, but it works for me. And I think it's well worth the investment a few times a year. But yeah, I've always been lucky in my career that I've been surrounded by great people. And it's just, you know, and some people come and go from your life, but the characters stay somewhat the same. So there's always the kind of there's always the kind of the work confidant, the really close friend at work who you're kind of in cahoots with. And that person often, in my experience, kind of is quite different to me. So they tend to be maybe quieter, more thoughtful, maybe not introverted, I guess is the word I'm looking for. And through my career, I've had a succession of people like that in college and in work who've kind of fit that bill. And so the people have changed, but the roles that you kind of support yourself with stay the same.
Okay, that's interesting.
I've been blessed as well to work with a few great bosses over the years. And I think that's for someone in work, for someone in employment, having a boss who values you and someone who's confident in their own skin and their own ability. And I mean, like, truly confident, not someone who's cocky, because that's usually overcompensating for something else, but someone who's genuinely okay in their own skin. Maybe okay in their own skin is better than confident. Who isn't intimidated by your dreams and your goals. And someone who is going to take joy in you achieving. That's really, really, really critical. So if you can find roles with those bosses, or if you're in the organization and if a role comes up working for someone who fits that bill, go for it. Spend some time working with that person, because that person will accelerate your growth.
Yeah, that's interesting. You often will hear people talk about a particular role and not really talk that much, or it's an afterthought about who the boss is actually going to be and what's the influence and impact that's going to have on them. Because quite often, you know, the who can be much more important than the what.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Very good.
So some of my best roles, some of my most enjoyable roles where I've grown the most have been roles I wouldn't have applied for, you know, just a few years beforehand. Or where they were just kind of, I applied for them because I was going to get working with a certain group of people.
You often hear, I could call them mantras, if you will. You know, there's, you know, catchphrases or whatever, which are useful sometimes in order to be able to remember, you know, quick recall of a concept or an idea. But, you know, there's bad mantras out there as well, which, you know, if you listen to them, then I think there's a potential that you miss an opportunity, because you're not really looking at the situation. You're just trotting out, you know, a mantra that you've learned or that you've heard. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite ones is, you know, the customer's always right. My experience, you know, in the sort of work that I do, quite a lot of the time, the customer doesn't even know what they want. And part of my role is to help them understand what they actually want and need, or sometimes that can actually be different. You know, they may want something, but it may not be the thing that they need. In your world, in your kind of production engineering, operational excellence type of thing, do you have any ideas or any thoughts on, you know, mantras that you hear that when you actually put them to work in the field, simply don't stack up? It's like, hang on, well, that's not my experience of how this works.
So if I was to get very technical for a moment, there's a concept, or there's a technique in the lean world called plan, do, check, act. And while it's sound in principle, when you see it applied in the real world, people just jump straight to act. It's like, so you're...
Jump straight to solutions.
The kind of... The counter to that is DMAIC, which is where you define, measure, analyze, improve, and then control. And I think that's a much more effective technique because, you're frontlining, you're front-loading the work. You're saying, we're going to spend some time defining what the problem is, and then we're going to measure the current state, and then we're going to analyze what that is, and then we're going to go and we're going to improve it. Whereas the plan, do, check, act, people are like, yeah, we've got a plan and we're going to act. So people go straight to planning. They think plan is, plan for the solution. And they go straight, jump straight in, like, yeah, fix this.
I also think that if you subscribe to the mantra, if you start using these mantras, then a lot of the time you miss out on an opportunity to really help somebody because you've not really listened, you're not really communicating with them. So can you think of, in your area, in your experience, is there any of these mantras that you kind of hear and they make your skin crawl a little bit? You're like, not this one again.
Yeah, I can't think of a specific kind of catchphrasey type one, but I read a really interesting post on LinkedIn the other day around, and it was from a hiring perspective, and it was about, the guy was being slightly facetious and he was saying stuff like, I heard a single parent and they were, like the advice would be, avoid single parents because they won't be able to be dedicated. But, they were. And, I heard a young person with no experience, but they knocked out of the park. And I think it's just around avoiding stereotypes. I think there's a time for, we talked about models a little while ago and stereotypes, and there's a time for these things because they help you to frame a problem, maybe.
Yeah.
But you also have to be very aware of the biases they cause. And so, just because someone has a typo on their CV, it doesn't mean they haven't got fantastic attention to detail. Just because... someone arrives at an interview 5 minutes late, doesn't mean the punctuality issue. And so it's about exploring the reasons behind behaviours and, sometimes giving people the benefit of the doubt. Very often we're quick to judge other people's behaviours through our own lens. And that's just not appropriate because we wouldn't like to be viewed by other people through other people's lenses, I think of a classic example from a few years ago where I was doing some interviews in a company, internal interviews for a promotion from a frontline role to a very junior supervisory role. And the best guy by a long shot, by a country mile, this guy was the best candidate. We knew all the candidates really well because they were all internal. This guy had been knocking it out of the park performance-wise for many, many years. And the other manager who was doing the interviews with me didn't want to give him the promotion because in the promotion interview, when asked about his motivations, he mentioned money. He says, look, I have another child on the way. I need the money. And this person was like, oh, no, we shouldn't. I wouldn't give someone a promotion based on them wanting more money. It would have to be because they wanted the role and because they were. The irony of it was that this person was a millionaire.
Right.
This person was an actual millionaire, banked with the Queen's Bank, Coutts, right?
Okay, yeah.
And was wanting to deny a guy on probably 22,000 or 23,000 pounds, a £2,000 increase. This person also had no children. No dependents. And that's fine. Like, I'm not knocking the life that person had built for themselves. But she was in a position where she didn't need to go for jobs for money. She had met that threshold of where, she owned her house outright. She had plenty of money in the bank. She had a massive pension. she didn't need to worry about money the same way an immigrant with a second child on the way on an entry-level salary had to worry about it. And I thought that was really telling about personal bias. And just in the interest of finishing the story, the guy got the promotion and he's absolutely still knocking it out of the park.
Very good.
But yeah, that, just kind of being aware of mantras, they're not all bad, you know. But sticking, never do this or I never do that, it's like, well, never is a very, very, very long time term.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. No, thanks for sharing that.
No worries.
Something that, you know, a lot of my questions have been around specific ideas or whatever, and you've shared, and I thank you for that, you shared quite a lot of your own personal experience and history. But there's one area, because I know you, I've got an advantage here, but there's one area that we haven't really spoken about, and I think it would be really interesting just to kick that around for a little bit and just see what your thoughts on it are. You were involved in politics in Ireland for a number of years, and you stood for election, council, local elections. Yeah. Do you want to just talk a little bit around what motivated you to put yourself up for that, get involved, put your face on the posters for those who don't know the way elections are run in Ireland? Posters on lampposts are extremely important. But it's a very, very visual, you know, your name's just not on the ballot. It's on every lamppost in town type of thing.
Yeah.
So I'd just be really curious about one, just, you know, your motivations as to why. And I suppose it ties in with the leadership thing again and wanting to help people. But if you could just talk about that for a little bit, and then maybe we have a little conversation around what's that actually like? You know, being out there, being so visible, knocking on people's doors, talking on the doorstep. You know, talk about instant feedback, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. I guess, you know, if you go right back to the start of the conversation, I spoke about my CV, if you look at it in totality, having some interesting pieces on it and things that maybe don't stack up or don't look like a normal career. But for me, I mean, and you've nailed it there, it's about people and it's about that desire to help people. I guess where it was one of the drivers that I don't normally talk about was the fact that I wasn't enjoying my job at the time. And I wasn't getting that leadership fix through work. And I was really yearning for it. And so I was involved in coaching rugby, and I was getting a little bit of it there. And I've always been interested in current affairs and politics. And at the time, Ireland at the time, we're talking about kind of 2006, 2007, when I started getting involved, 2009, when I actually stood for election. That was a big time in our history. You know, we were at the top of a cycle as regards credit and house prices. And a lot of people were in denial about it, including the government at the time. And a lot of people wanted the party to continue. And there was a lot, but then there was an awful lot of people going, this is madness. This can't go on. And and even at the same time, then you had, you know, the country was bringing in record revenues, and there was massive social issues. There was no playgrounds for kids. We were building estates. Housing estates, your residential areas with no amenities, you know, turning very small villages, basically crossroads in the countryside, into towns without any improvement or upgraded infrastructure. Roads, I mean, roads in Ireland are a massive problem anyway. And so it was just all this stuff was going on, and just decided to get involved and really just wanted to get involved in a political party and just see how it worked and whatever. And then the opportunity came up. I was approached and asked if I'd be interested in running for the local elections for the council. And I was like, yeah, look, that sounds awesome. That's, you know, it's a way to impact on people's lives. it's a way to make a difference in the community. At a time when I really felt that we needed to do things slightly differently. Actually, very, very differently. When I say slightly, we needed to do things really differently. And so, yeah, I stood for election, and it was a really, really interesting experience. And it was my first probably experience of people treating me very differently. So people I worked with all of a sudden viewed me in a completely different light. And even though I was the same, because for me, really nothing had changed, because I was on this journey of, I'm interested in politics, I'll get involved in the local constituency organization, I'll be on the leadership team of the constituency organization, I'll, you know, offer to help out with canvassing, etc., knocking on doors. And then it was it didn't feel like a massive jump to become a candidate, because you're keeping the company then of, you know, of people who are members of parliament, people who are members of the European Parliament, senators, councillors, so it just becomes normal. And that's a really interesting point that we kind of haven't talked about. You are so influenced by your external environment. So if you're hanging around with people who are not going anywhere in their lives, or that's going to rub off on you. If you're hanging around with really ambitious people, that's going to rub off on you. So being in that environment, surrounded by and meeting members of parliament and that on a regular basis, it becomes very normal to just kind of go, yeah, I wouldn't mind being a member of parliament or a senator or a councillor. That just becomes normal. But then your face is on a poster, and people who you know and know you, but don't know you that well, all of a sudden they're like, your face is on the, you're a councillor, you're going for the council. What's like,
do you think there's an element of like, who do you think you are type of thing?
With a very small minority. Most people were really like, wow, well done, fair play.
Okay.
That's amazing. Like, genuinely, it was a really positive experience. Really, really positive. And you get the doors slammed in your face. You get the people who blame you for all the social ills. Even though you're not yet elected to anything, even though your party hasn't been in government for, you know, 15 years, you're the guy standing at the door, they're pissed off,
sounds
so they're going to shout at
like
you.
Sounds like Twitter the live show.
Yeah, pretty much. And you never know, as you scroll through the housing estate, as you scroll through the doors, you never know what's coming next.
Yeah.
And the vast, vast majority of it was positive. The vast, vast majority of it was positive. And people were encouraging, even people who you knew weren't good to vote for you would be really, really nice. You get some unfavorable comments, but it's like everything else in life. You kind of you focus on the positive and you move on. And it was a fantastic experience, and it taught me a lot about myself, about resilience, about what I like doing, what I don't like doing. I don't mind being the front man. I quite comfortable in a supporting role, but I guess it was, you know, one of my first times really publicly being the front man for something. And that I found that really enjoyable and satisfying. Overall it was a fantastic experience. Unfortunately, I became a victim of the recession myself. So when I went into politics, 2008, 2009, the country had hit that speed bump, and very soon thereafter, we were in an IMF bailout program, that coincided then with the company I was working for shutting the facility I worked at. That event happened in parallel. It wasn't actually connected. It was because the drug we were making came off patent. And I ended up looking for work in 2012, 2013. And that work was not in my hometown of Cork. And so for a while I was commuting between Cork and Galway, which is, you know, a 4-hour drive. So I was 4 nights a week in Galway and and 3 nights a week in Cork, and I would get down for my council meetings, but it was becoming more and more difficult to be an effective councillor if you're out of the constituency for that length. And then a role came up with a great company based in the UK, and I had a choice between, you know, that political career and my actual career, and I just felt that the right decision for me and the family was to leave politics and focus on the career and focus on the family. And I think it, again, that thematically going back to my decision to leave the Navy, it was again focused on family, except this time I very definitely had a wife and two children to provide for. And it was a very, very difficult decision. I felt that I could have gone further in politics. I might still jump back in at some point in the future. Having said that, when I left in 2013, there was a huge sense of relief because I was going to work and having conversations about football and what was on TV last night, instead of getting bombarded with complaints about, well, the government have done this and the pothole outside my house is still not fixed. And so I kind of got my life back.
Okay.
And that was quite a relief. I didn't realize how much of an impact it was having on me. But what it did do was it gave me back a huge amount of time and energy. And then I was able to reinvest that time and energy in my career. And I think it showed me, I think a bit like the cadetship and a bit like the MBA, it pushed me and showed me how much more I could do, how much more I was capable of, how, you know, if you invest the hours, you know, instead of watching TV, instead of, you know, going to the pub, if you put that time and energy into more productive things, it shows what can be achieved. And I went to the UK, took a risk, moving my wife and kids to a city that didn't have a great reputation, that being the beautiful Dundee, which actually turns out is a wonderful place to live.
Yeah, I concur with that. I've been to visit a few times.
Yeah, fabulous city. And I just hope that it's had a few setbacks again recently, and I just hope it comes through them, because it's a great, great place and it's full of wonderful people. And I don't say that lightly. I genuinely mean it. It's a wonderful city. And we took a hit financially. The money wasn't as good as what I was able to make in Ireland. But the career opportunity was there, and we doubled down. It was really, really tough. Really, really tough on the family. Really tough on my wife. And when you talk about the support system, she did a lot of the heavy lifting with our children when they were very young. And my son has autism. And we were going through that whole process. We didn't know at the time when we moved, and then we went through that whole process of diagnosis while we were in the UK.
Yeah, what age and were the kids when you moved?
The youngest, Jasmine, was about 14 months.
Okay.
14, 15 months, and so Robin would have been almost 3.
Yeah. Yeah, that's no small decision to make, you know. It's a big move.
It was huge.
Particularly, as you said, you know, when we spoke about the Navy earlier on and your reasonings for leaving, and you said, you know, family, and you've got, you know, a wider family that you're quite close to.
Yeah.
And then to make the decision to go, actually, do you know what? I need to leave that. We need to pack up and go somewhere else and start again. Mm-hmm. So that's with kids that young as well, that's a big decision.
Yeah. But I mean, it is. But then I was following the footsteps of, you know, generations of Irish immigrants who'd gone abroad and particularly gone to the UK and been very successful. And I had great examples in my own life. Yourself, you had gone to the UK, and I remember, because you know what I'm talking about, even before I say it, right? I'm talking about when I dropped you off in Leicester. And you headed up the road to Newcastle for the first time.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, you're actually moving to the UK. I'm like, this is happening. Right, okay. And you blazed that trail and you showed me that it could be done. And you showed me how successful, you know, somebody could be, how you build a successful life. And I don't just mean career wise, I mean just a really good life with good friends and good social life and good, just a good life. And my sister was doing the same thing in Aberdeen at the time. She had moved over, and she had found love, and had settled down in Aberdeen. And so I had other friends. I was like, I can do this too. I can, if I'm brave enough and if I work, I can be like these guys. I can go. And we did, we went, and yes, the job was good, but we built a great life and we made great friends. And we had a wonderful life as a family in Scotland. And I guess that was the unintended consequence of going over there for the career. But it was fantastic. And it was kind of with a heavy heart that we moved home to Ireland again. But, you know, circumstances. Again, you have to be scanning your external environment and working in the pharmaceutical industry for a contract manufacturing company, small company, and then facing the uncertainties around Brexit, etc.
Yeah.
It felt like the good time to take some of the risk out of the situation and move home.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, well, thank you for your kind words on my little escapade across to the UK. But
Fifteen years.
But it does. It feels a little bit like it kind of does an element of that, you know, rebirth or regrowing going on again with my move down to Dubai. So I've been here before in one way. I've experienced it. It's a challenge. It's a challenge. I think when you go somewhere and things go well and you build a good life for yourself, it can be a bit of a challenge then to move on from that again, because,
yeah,
you know, it's good, but the time comes and it's time to move on and you have to embrace that. I think a little bit like what you said about moving back to Ireland, you know, you left with a heavy heart, but I think knowing your situation and your circumstances, I think it was the right decision. Mm-hmm. At the right time. You know, just because something feels hard or difficult doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. They're not the same thing. So, yeah. Interesting.
I try to be.
Well, David, listen, thank you so much for your time today and taking the opportunity to talk to us.
My pleasure. It's been great. Very cathartic in some ways, actually.
Very good. And there's a bill in the post for the counselling session.
Yeah. Very good.
All right. Cheers, Dave. Thank you.